Well, it's great to be back again with you. Thank you for your efforts here. I would ask that you look with me at this notebook, just for the sake of our hearts, in light of what we just sang. Let's go to page 92. This will be for tomorrow, but I realize that not everyone here right now will be here tomorrow. So I want to give us calibration of our hearts. Let's look at this first paragraph on page 92. Man-centered approaches to the subject of human existence typically focus on arguments for and against naturalistic evolution. Some Christian approaches make faith in the Bible the central issue, but an even more biblical approach points beyond the means and to the end purpose of all, the glory of God and the joy of man. What I'm trying to say is this is not first just a defense of the faith to try to convince you of an argument. Number two, it's not primarily an interest just to get you to believe in the Bible, just to believe in God, just to believe in the biblical account. It's much more than that. The call of this conference and the purpose of our gathering is not man-centered. It's not for us to get an argument or win an argument or stand on one side or the other. Our effort is for God, God-centeredness, that our hearts would worship Him more. So I say this all as preface, because in this session we're going to go over some details, some scientific details about the theory of evolution. And my reluctance is I don't want the details to distract your heart. I want that they would be used of God only to encourage and strengthen a God-centered adoration. All right, with that in mind, I think I should take a moment to just show you in the back. If you'd look with me on page 126, I would be remiss if I didn't remind everyone here that there are some really outstanding resources available to you online. It is amazing what is freely available just with a click of a few strokes on the internet. Two of my favorite sites is going to be ICR, the Institute for Creation Research. As one exiting the scientific field, I actually entertained the possibility of going on staff at ICR. I actually had a 700-level, graduate-level class taught as a scientific advisor. I taught a cosmology class at the Master's Seminary, and I also was an adjunct substitute professor at the Master's University for the physics class. I had interest to go to ICR, but the Lord brought me here, for which I have absolutely no regrets. Love Him, thank Him for it. But ICR, I highly recommend, and Answers in Genesis, two excellent resources that have an incredible amount of quality research and documentation. I list for you a few other sites, some of which are better than others. One that I do really highly recommend is at number three, not as well known, Jonathan Sarfati. It's a very wonderful scholar. I love him so much from what I have read and come to know. I highly recommend his works. Any book that he writes, I buy it and read it. Jonathan Sarfati, he's a chess master. He has played 12 simultaneous chess games blindfolded. So he's not your average Joe. He's Jewish in ethnicity, born in Australia, speaks British Australian, lives in America, and has a French last name. Very interesting character. Anyway, I mention him because that bullet point number three, creation.com, that's a ministry he started, and it's out of Australia. Now he's here in America. But anyway, it's excellent resources there. He has done a fantastic job. He's actually an optical physicist, and I've enjoyed reading some of his technical stuff. With that in mind, I do want to point out one other. Down toward the bottom, I listed, they don't deserve to be among these others, but I listed just a few couple sites that I have, And creationsearch.org is one that I just started, and I am improving on it, and I'm looking forward to seeing this thing take off in some way. It basically, all it is a portal. It has no other value. It doesn't maintain anything. All it is it's a way that I was able to programmatically leverage search engines where I limit your searches to only go onto a series. I have about 15 different fairly quality creation research sites. So you can go to this one place, creationsearch.org, type in a question, and you're going to get a list from Answers in Genesis, ICR, creation.com, and all kinds of other places that deal with creation. So those are some examples. And the bibliography, again, is there for your perusal. With that in mind, I invite you to turn over with me to page 47. Our subject in this session will be evolution, the explanatory theory of naturalism. And that is what we're talking about. It is an explanatory theory seeking to explain something for the naturalistic worldview. Let's begin by considering again the impact of this theory. Michael Denton, I'll mention a few of these names and I'll try to explain a bit about them. Michael Denton is another incredible individual. He has a medical degree and a biochemistry degree. He is a biochemist physician, agnostic. In 1985, he published a landmark work called Evolution, a Theory in Crisis, with absolutely no religious agenda. He was not writing from a Christian perspective, and he had no interest in supporting Christianity or the Bible. In fact, he didn't quote the Bible one time. What he did in this book of over 300 pages is systematically dismantle the fallacies and the frauds of evolution. And he did it, again, just out of a compelling desire for good science. I highly commend someone like that. That's a grace of God that he moved among a man like Michael Denton. So I quote him a lot. I enjoy his works. He published that in 1985. I just recently bought his second work, or he's written several, but I bought his next work. It's called Evolution, A Theory Still in Crisis, 30 years later. You would think after 30 years, you might have improved or cleaned up some of the things you were charged for. He writes this next volume of a similar substance, 400 pages or something, and just, again, goes back and hits new issues, doesn't just repeat himself, hits all kinds of new issues. It's fantastic. So I'm quoting him quite a few times. I think, again, he's worthy because he's not specifically talking about evolution or talking about it's against evolution from a Christian perspective, and that's helpful. It helps to remove some of the bias. Evolution, he says, has come to touch every aspect of modern thought, and no other theory in recent times has done more to mold the way we view ourselves and our relationship to the world around us. Very just clear observation. It's a very massive theory. It impacts us all over. Phil Johnson, he's actually a professor of law at UC Berkeley. What's fascinating about that, you'll find guys like Johnson and others who write, and I find it very, very interesting. Johnson was one on the scene who, again, a landmark work. He came Darwin on Trial. Great book. He is personally, he professes to be a Christian, but he doesn't write from a Christian perspective trying to support Christianity. He simply writes as a lawyer. What I find interesting about that, what is a lawyer? What business does he have dealing with science? Just this. Lawyers are highly skilled and highly trained individuals on looking at claims and evidences and thinking and rationalizing logically. That's what he brings. He is an excellent, logician. He brings in the claims that are made and he dismantles those claims based upon, again, forensics, evidence, and various other logical inconsistencies. So he has a voice to listen to. Darwin on Trial, Defeating Darwinism. He has several other works that are worth looking at, The Wedge of Truth and so forth. This philosophy, he says, evolution, controls academic work not only in science but in all fields, including law, literature, and psychology. It has impacted our world. John Dunphy says this, the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in public school classroom by teachers who correctly perceive their role as the proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity. I think he's right. And notice how that was said well before him by a man named Adolf Hitler. Let me control the textbooks and I'll control the state. So if we can get into the education system, we can make a big impact and ultimately control the way people live by controlling the way they think. Henry Morris, he is a Christian, largely attributed as the founder of the creationism movement. Wonderful individual. I've met him in person, talked with him. I loved him. He's gone to be with the Lord. He's a hydrologist and a geologist, highly skilled, earned doctorates. He says, evolution has now become the dominant philosophy and for several generations has been taught as fact in practically all our schools. From elementary school to university graduate schools, evolutionary assumptions also dominate the news media and all our public institutions. It seems obvious that an issue that is so vitally significant ought to be seriously studied by all thinking men and women. I agree. Let's look on page 48 for the definitions. The definitions of evolution. Ernest Mayr, remember, is a biologist, evolutionary biologist in Harvard. He says, evolution is a change in a population over time of the proportions of individual organisms that differ in one or more genetically determined traits. Well, that's a very loose definition. Let me just make this abundantly clear. Nobody disputes that organisms change. Change is not the question. It's not the issue. It's the type of change that you're advocating. So this definition isn't very helpful. Another comes in and says that the transformation of genetic variation originally present within populations into variation between populations in both space and time. Lots of words to say, basically, creating through genetics change in one group that moves into making a new one. And here is the National Association of Biology Teachers. This is the official statement. Currently, you can go to their website. This is the official statement for biology teachers in the United States of America. And this is their statement. Evolution is an unsupervised, impersonal, unpredictable, and natural process of descent with genetic modification that is affected by natural selection, change, and changing environments. It's a pretty good definition. I especially appreciate unsupervised, impersonal, unpredictable, natural. At least they're being consistent with, indeed, Darwin's original theory. You'll notice I have macro and micro listed there. We need to be careful about that. I used to be more dogmatic about it. I think we do need to be sensitive to know that the idea of just the bringing about of a new species, if we define it from what Linnaeus gave us, kingdom, phylum, class, family, order, species, if it's the seventh on the rung of taxonomy, just that little, if it just means that maybe it's not breedable anymore with one of its predecessors, that's not necessarily what we're saying doesn't happen. What the biblical worldview doesn't say, that's not possible. The biblical worldview simply says God created distinct types called kinds, and those kinds came equipped with the genetic information necessary to reproduce after its own kind. Certainly, variation is a part of his wonderful and wise design. And variation that includes mutation, that might mean that backward compatibility with reproduction might fail in some cases. That's part of adaptation. Isolation can cause it. So don't allow macro, micro, don't allow those lines to be fighting grounds, like that's the line you're going to draw on if evolution says, look, we can prove that a species now, a new birth, cannot reproduce with a predecessor of its own kind. We've proved you wrong. You haven't proved anything wrong. That's just mutation within a kind. Okay? You following me? So my point is on page 48, I showed macro, which means large view, evolution that goes literally from an amoeba to you. A highly complex, intelligent, and yes, every one of you is intelligent, a highly complex, intelligent, 125 trillion cell hosting creature from an amoeba, a single celled organism. That is what the Bible says does not happen. And that's what we're saying is our loose use of the word macro. Micro is simply the idea of variation within a kind or type. And that, I would argue, that is not only possible, it is actually part of the wisdom of God. And it is part of what we see in the Bible as He separates people. So, with that in mind, on page 49, I have here another book I commend, Jonathan Wells. This was another one of those landmark works. This is an ID proponent, which means an intellectual design. He's not really advocating a biblical worldview. He's just simply saying that the scientific evidence demands some intelligence behind it. That's not satisfactory. It's not enough to a biblicist, to a biblical worldview, but at least it is a scientific evidence. Well, anyway, he writes this book, and it's very good. I think that, again, it landed pretty hard in the scientific community. He himself is a double PhD from Yale and Berkeley, a very qualified individual. He writes very articulately, very simple to understand, yet he's very knowledgeable. And he lists, and I list there for you, the main areas he covers, and I summarize them. It's worth your looking at later. He goes over, and what he really does in this book is he says, look, really evolution continues to be promoted in the school systems based upon a few icons, not based upon an overwhelming set of evidence, not based upon an outworking theory that is demonstrated, but rather a few icons that keep kind of posters, that just keep pointing to those posters. And again, these are very important. He shows how each one of them is a failure. These icons are idols in the sanctuary of evolution, and they're all dead. And he shows that, and it's very striking. I would, again, just commend that work to you. And you can read my little summary of each of those sections. Tempted to explain each one, but I can't. Evolution, let's consider now as a theory. I'm on page 50, and I want to share with you just how, you know, sometimes we think evolution, well, Darwin came up with it. Darwin didn't come up with it. No, Darwin is an interesting fellow, smart man, interesting combination of circumstances, right place, right time, right connections. But he wasn't the first. In fact, he didn't even really invent the theory of evolution. It goes way, way back. We find evolution starting all the way back 450 BC. It was a Greek, again, back in the whole Greek idea of just look at something and just come up with a conclusion, don't test it. Well, this indeed happened. In the again, we find in 450 BC, pre-Socratic records talking about evolution. But this kind of evolution is really a strange evolution. This was the kind, in fact, there's drawings of it, that show, you know, basically a horse giving birth to a half horse, half man kind of evolution. Like suddenly out of one birth generation, you have this whole new strange creature. It was at a time where people would come across a creature they've never seen and say, wow, where did that come from? And just theorize. Well, maybe that just came out of something before. This is the one that's closer to Darwin that is really a problem because Darwin actually believed it to start with, and it's one that most people don't know. It's an embarrassment to the scientific community. This is Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. I love to talk about this because it is the most ridiculous little thing. It basically is the theory of evolution on the basis of acquired characteristic, which means Arnold Schwarzenegger would have very strong babies. It's the idea that an adult person, if they did something in their adult life that affected their body in that experience, that trait is passed on. So if you work out your muscles, then your baby's going to be born with more muscles. Or if you're really smart, or you do so, or you learn math, then that baby's going to have math proficiencies. And so forth. You can imagine all the other variations. But that's Lamarck. He actually thought, and this is amazing, he actually wrote a theory on why the giraffe has such a long neck. And Darwin adopted it. And the theory was that, well, it was a season in Africa where there was a drought, and so animals started dying off, and there was too much competition to eat the low-hanging leaves and fruit, and so the horse-like creatures stretched. And as the adults stretched, the next generation had more to stretch, and the next generation more to stretch, and they just kept stretching until they got to the 18.5-foot tall body they have. Well, that's Lamarck, and it is laughable. It's ridiculous. That's not scientific at all. And again, it is what Darwin began with. In fact, he was a contemporary of Darwin for a little bit. Edward Blyth, though, is probably the most the saddest case in the whole thing, because he actually was the first one. He was a chemist and a zoologist. He published articles on natural selection. He actually talked about natural selection, the idea that the one that is more fit to survive will continue, and the one that isn't so fit to survive will die off. And therefore, dominant traits that make one more fit will persevere. And he wrote these articles. They were circulated. In fact, Darwin has, many have commented on this, and there seems to be some evidence in letters, that Darwin read Blyth and was inspired by him. So you might, hopefully you're thinking, well, why didn't Blyth get the credit? Well, it just so happened to be that he was a Christian who believed in special creation and used natural selection in his thesis as merely an explanation for limited variation within kinds. Edward Blyth would agree with what we're saying here. And yet he's the one who first came up with natural selection. Interesting. Didn't go anywhere, wasn't popular, because it didn't satisfy a worldview. Now, one more. We have, supposed to have one more. There will be another one coming. And that's Gregory Mendel. Mendel was a monk. Augustinian monk. This is on page 50 at the bottom. Can we get... Yeah, thanks, guys. He was a botanist. He is attributed as the founder, father of genetics, and he too theorized a form of natural selection on the basis of genetics. And again, that is contemporary with Charles Darwin. In fact, and I have this in your notes... He published, I thought I had it in your notes, I don't, but Mendel actually published before Darwin, I'm sorry, he wrote before Darwin, didn't publish, it sat in the monastery because he was just busy doing his thing, wasn't trying to make a name for himself, and yet later some came across his work, published it, and people realized, wait a second, he came up with this before Darwin did. Problem is, Blyth and Mendel, both Christians, both had Christian worldviews and would not satisfy the worldview needs that loved Darwin. So this isn't working again, guys. So let's look on page 51. I want to consider Charles Darwin and just his life. I understand a little bit of the background and the contributing factors to this theory. In 1809, Darwin was born. He was born to a British family. His father was a physician and aristocrats. They were wealthy. He had another brother. They were a part of the Church of England. There was a lot there in terms of, again, honor, respect in that society. Darwin had some problems. He was a man who really didn't do a lot of, didn't show much affection in his family. They didn't have a lot of affection. He was always sent off to tutors and boarding school, and sort of had a rebellious streak in him. He ended up getting involved with a girl too young, was promiscuous, and the father had to shut that down because of his name in the society. It would bring about reproach, so he sent him away. He sent him to Cambridge, to Christ College, that he could be a clergyman. So he sends Charles Darwin away because of his disobedience, his immorality. He sends him out so that he could be taught and schooled in theology. That's an amazing thought. 1827. He was 18 years old. By 1831, he was 22 years old. By this time, you'll notice the time factor there. It's only a few years. What's interesting is he actually, on record at Cambridge, was only enrolled for 18 months. So in between, he ditched school, didn't complete his work, and was looking for alternatives to keep him busy. And his father, actually, one time he ran away. His uncle was a lawyer, a very wealthy lawyer, and paid to have him put back, and on the story goes. As he ends up staying there, or continuing his time there at Cambridge, he came across a botanist in the college there, in the university, in one of the other college schools, and began a job with him as an apprentice. So now he's working with this guy to help this guy with his botany work. Darwin was basically, the water boy, the go fetch me something. And he was doing this to keep him busy, to make some money, and because it was required by his family, his father and his uncle. Now, what happened was, in 1831, this botanist that he was serving, helping at the university, was going on this grand expedition, a five-year survey of exotic land around the Cape. They went down and went around South America. And so on Her Majesty's ship Beagle, set sail, left Devonport, England in 1831 with Darwin on board. Darwin had, it is recorded, two books with him. One was the Holy Bible, and one was John Milton's Paradise Lost. As he boarded this ship, he went on the expedition for 5 years, not to return. In that time, they hit the Galapagos Islands. And those are islands 600 miles off the southwest coast of Ecuador. What most people don't know is Darwin didn't go there as a scientist, and he didn't go there equipped with apparatus, and he didn't go there and set up camp for a few years to do his investigation. Darwin was there assisting, collecting specimens for the one he's helping. He had interest, to be sure. He was a naturalist. But he didn't have education in the field. And he was there, most people don't realize, for 5 months. I'm sorry, 5 weeks. Just over a month. He was only there for about 5 weeks on the Galapagos Islands that had now been sort of, made a shrine. In that time, he witnessed a few interesting creatures he had never seen, like some turtles, sea turtles, and certain plants. And then he also observed some of the finch birds, five of which he brought back to England, five different kinds. Well, he did return, never to return to England, never to return to the Galapagos again. That's striking. And it was 25 years later that he developed his theory of to propose naturalistic explanation for the diversity of life. Took him 25 years after that. In that time, he's reading Blythe, and he's reading other sources and other discussions, and he's reading one other important individual by the name of Charles Lyell. Charles Lyell, I have on the next page, 52, was the founder of Uniformitarianism. Lyell basically was a friend of Darwin through the family, and he was an anti-Christian. He had an agenda in some way to remove the Bible from England. Well, he came up with this concept. He was a lawyer and a geologist, and he came up with this idea, the key, again, the present is the key to the past, the slogan that became the champion of uniformitarianism. And it was through Charles Lyell and his influence upon Darwin's return that Darwin started to say, if the earth is really that old, then maybe change can happen step by step by step by step. You see, Lyell on the scene at the time, the worldview in England was that the earth was only just about 6,000 years old. In fact, the president at Oxford at the time, James Usher, Bishop Usher published a book that identified the time. Anyway, the worldview was about 6,000 years old. Well, when Lyell came on the scene, he actually published a work that suggested that the earth was at least 100,000 years old, and everybody was up in arms. Are you crazy? And then he adjusted it in his lifetime to say, no, I was wrong. It's 300,000 years old. And it was a big deal. Everyone's, are you crazy? 300,000? Well, that was all that Darwin needed to hear. 300,000, he took that and he ran with it, and he began to articulate, again, his ideas. He says this, if I were convinced that I required such additions, saltations, as they're called, to the theory of natural selection, I would reject it as rubbish. He is saying, I despise all theories of evolution where you move from one level of a species with characteristics to a whole new level. He says it must be very, very gradual. It has to be naturalistic. And what's the mechanism? What's the need, the facilitator for that? Long, long periods of time. So Darwin again says variations are supposed to be extremely slight. They are not supposed at all to appear simultaneously, but often after long intervals of time. So he insisted, and this is what made his theory powerful. Natural selection is a scientific, observable theory. The conclusions of where it applies is false, but the idea of slight modification based upon mutation does happen. He kept insisting it has to be slight, slight, slight. That is true. He goes on, there seems to me too much misery in the world. Now this I'm pointing out, if you notice here on 52, the non-scientific origin. What are the influencing factors here to Darwin? Well, this was the main thing he says himself made him think about the theory. To displace special creation. This is what Darwin said himself, and he writes it in his Origin of Species. There seems to me too much misery in the world. That doesn't sound like a scientific problem. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created, catch those two phrases, designedly created the parasitic wasp with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that the cat should play with the mice. That is not a scientific problem. That is a philosophical problem. You can't bring yourself to believe it. The real issue here, and by the way, Darwin wrote this after, and he journals in one of his journal papers, not in the Origin, but in his journal paper, he talks about how he came across, in England, he came across on a pathway a deer that had been wounded and was suffering and dying on the side of the road. And he had compassion for the poor deer, and he thought to himself, I can't understand why this is happening. This did two things. It pushed God away from the world that God created. Darwin then adopted a deistic mindset, a worldview where God was distant, yet still creator. Seven times in the Origin of Species, in fact, I have them documented for you with page numbers, seven times in the Origin of Species, Darwin calls God the creator. So he wasn't an atheist. He was a deist. He believed that God created. He simply thought God was so removed, and all the variation, including the evils in the world, were the result of naturalistic processes. So, a major thing, just by the way, footnote for theology's sake, please remember, these kinds of philosophical problems come from poor theology. Misery is the consequence of sin. It is a signpost that is intended to scream to every human being that they might grope for God. and find hope in redemption. Misery and suffering is not a useless thing. And it's not, and it is therefore something that a benevolent, beneficent, loving, omniscient, omnipotent God would allow for the sake of drawing his children to himself. They didn't understand the curse very well. Darwin certainly didn't. So with that in mind, let's think about the idea, this non-scientific origin of his theory. First of all, it is not inspired by a scientific problem. It was a philosophical problem, an emotional problem. Secondly, it was not inspired by observable evidence. It wasn't like he saw things in the microscope or saw things in his taxonomy. It was inspired by things he didn't want to believe. Third, it's not inspired or not in response to a failing scientific concept. Whenever new scientific theories arise that are not in response to failing scientific theories, you need to question that. You need to look at that more carefully. Where did you get this from? Why are you proposing this? Most, by the way, just on a note, most of what we looked at in our last sessions have been what? These scientific theories that were coming up were in response to all the silliness of the ancients, making science a corrective truth pursuit. Now, response, it's not, again, it's a response to a failing theological misconception. That's where he originally was motivated. So Michael Denton tells us, and again, page 53, you find all the quotes there of Darwin in his origin. And now I'm over on page 55. The effects of his theory, Michael Denton say, the acceptance of this great claim of the consequent elimination of God from nature was to play a decisive role in the secularization of Western society. Beloved friends, I would just remind you that, again, what happened here, Darwin quotes God several times. He concedes to a creator, but through the succession of his experience, he more and more became atheistic in his thinking. Never really fully pledged himself atheist, but he certainly became more and more such and talked like an atheist. What's interesting, though, is that he was not the one to champion the use of natural selection for atheism. It was Thomas Huxley. Thomas Huxley was a very wealthy businessman with a great deal of political connections and academic networking. He was an orator and a great debater. And Thomas Huxley took Darwin's theory and exploded a bombshell in London. He was called by many Darwin's bulldog. He was the one who fought for Darwin and made his and propagated his theory to the universities. Made a massive impact. Today, Richard Dawkins, a leading atheist, says, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. So we're seeing the non-scientific motivations behind it and the effects. This was, after all, the driving force to adopt Darwin's theory. It was a worldview looking for an explanation, a reason to sustain its worldview. And for a time, they thought they had it. For a time, because of the limitations that they had in not knowing how to disprove it, for a time, they thought this could prove it. But we now stand in an age of greater knowledge and greater insight, and this worldview cannot be supported any longer by evolution or any other theory of man. And that's important to note. Darwin says this himself, in the survival of favored individuals and races during the constantly recurring struggle for existence, we see a power and ever-acting form of selection. Page 53, this is where he formulates his theory of natural selection. Natural selection has these three main points, and we'll go through them very briefly. You'll find them. Point one on page 56. The mechanism is simple, slight graduation, micromutation, and functional advancement. Now, just for the sake of understanding what these notes are telling you, let me just explain. He insisted that change could not be miraculous, could not be a saltation, as he called it. A saltation was a jump unexplained. It had to be an ever slight change. So very, very gradual over long periods of time. So slight graduation assumes uniformitarianism. Slight graduation is the key to it being natural and not miraculous, or attributed to like the gods, where they thought that just out of nowhere, somehow a new creature could be born. The Greeks. Micromutations, it's a point-by-point mutation. We read earlier, Darwin says, changes cannot take place simultaneously. It has to be one at a time. He's striving to keep it natural. Functional advantage, advancement. Only those mutations that prove advantageous will propagate. These are the three pillars of his natural selection. He was against punctuated equilibrium, which is a dogma that is used by paleontologists today to try to support evolution. In fact, if you go even today on the website of UC Berkeley and try to look at their paleontological evidences, they'll point again to horse evolution and whale evolution, and they'll try to show you how we have this evidence, and it's all punctuated equilibrium. It's this idea of saltations. You move from one creature with these characteristics, and the next one on the line is this different creature. And the assumption is, but they're connected. And it's unnecessary to demand all the slight modifications. Well, according to the theory, those are necessary. So there's a neo-Darwinism today because his theory was too scientific on this level. Let's go on to look at some of these evidences. Darwin himself said, I would give nothing for the theory of natural selection if it requires miraculous additions at any one stage of descent. If you can't see a clear, gradual mutation, transmutation, then my theory is garbage. He says, natural selection can act only by the preservation and accumulation of infinitesimally small inherited modifications, each profitable to the preserved being. Those are the three pillars. Let's look at biology, page 58. You see the definitions there. It's a branch of science that deals with life. Bio, bios in Greek means life. So let's just walk through a few of these. So Darwin in his apparatus, it's an important thing to understand. I find it a bit striking, really. Darwin had only a microscope capable of 300 times power magnification. That's silly. You know, you can go to Walmart for about $15 and get a 1,200 power today. Serious. It's unbelievable. He had two microscopes with a maximum magnification factor of about 300. He did not see much difference between living matter and non-living matter. He said that himself. If you take a little scrap of, granite, a crystal, and you take a piece of a leaf, at 300 magnification, they don't look much different. That's because you're not looking close enough. So Walter Bradley says this. In 1905, Ernest Haeckel described living cells as being merely homogeneous globes or globules of plasm. In those days, they didn't have any way of seeing the complexity that exists within the membrane of the cell. But the truth is that a one-cell organism is more complicated than anything we've been able to recreate through supercomputers. Well, a 300-time microscope might be the problem. This is what an onion cell looks like at 100 power magnification. This is what they look like at 1,000. Now you've got, there's the cell wall, which was here, that same cell wall. Now there's the cell wall, and look inside. All kinds of little guys. Wonderful. Bradley again says this, A single cell organism is a high-tech factory, complete with artificial languages and decoding systems, central memory banks that store and retrieve impressive amounts of information, precision control systems that regulate the automatic assembly of components, proofreading and quality control mechanisms that safeguard against errors, assembly systems that use principles of prefabrication and molecular construction, and a complete replication system that allows the organism to duplicate itself at bewildering speeds. Doesn't sound like a globule of plasm. Sounds like a pretty complex little system of life. Proteins are the builders of living organisms. Proteins are amino acid polymers. These are a multi-differential type molecule. Amino acid is a small organic compound consisting of about 10 to 20 atoms. You put all this together, and it's a pretty complex chain. Each protein is a sort of micro-miniaturized machine, so small that it must be magnified a million times before it is visible to the human eye. That's a lot. So even the most basic cell in life that we know consists of a minimum of 445 proteins, each comprised of at least 239 amino acids, coming from 20 specific types, each made up of 10 to 20 atoms. That is an incredible complexity of combination. And then add to this that the amino acids don't all just connect to any other amino acids. They are like Legos. Some of them have a certain number to connect to another. They are right-handed and they are left-handed. And you have to have the right kind, not only in type, but also orientation, to be able to complement and connect like Legos. So the Urey Miller experiment, where they tried to assume what the atmosphere was like and throw a bunch of chemicals that they intelligently chose to put in the mix. And by the way, the Miller experiment, what they won't tell you what they did, is after they shocked it with electricity to try to get the amino acids to connect, what they did is they then allowed it to go through a gate and not go back in. Because what would happen is the atmosphere they created would have destroyed the very thing it combined. That does not sound like a natural experiment. It does not sound like the conditions of the world, even if there was a primordial soup in their idea. So the idea is, again, this is an amazing set of details that need to be connected. And it's fascinating to me, the complexity of life. It has never been demonstrated that you can bring about life, even from matter. Where does it come from? Michael Denton again says, the cell is, in effect, a veritable micro-miniaturized factory containing thousands of exquisitely designed pieces of intricate molecular machinery made up of 1,000 million atoms, far more complicated than any machine built by man and absolutely without parallel in the non-living world. Life is a miracle. It's beautiful. It's amazing. It's tremendously complex. Klaus Doe says, more than 30 years of experimentation on the life of origin of life have led to a better perception of the immensity of the problem rather than to its solution. This is old already. He said that a while ago. Think about it. The Miller experiment took place over 50 years ago now. And Miller actually spent the rest of his scientific career trying to recover from the claims made in the experiment, trying to prove that life could come from non-life, and never succeeded. And there have been millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars invested in that. In fact, Harvard just recently, in the past few years, took on yet another funded project of multiple millions of dollars to invest in the investigation of the origin of life. Spending millions of dollars to try to recreate the origin of life. Haven't done it. All of us who study the origin of life find that the more we look into it, the more we feel that it is too complex to have evolved anywhere. We believe, now this is an evolutionist, we believe as an article of faith that life evolved from dead matter on this planet. It is just that its complexity is so great, it is hard for us to imagine that it did. Maybe you need to check your presupposition. Frederick Hoyle says, to believe natural processes assembled a living cell is like believing a tornado could pass through a junkyard containing the bits and pieces of an airplane and leaving a Boeing 747 in its wake, fully assembled and ready to fly. And that's actually, it's what's silly about it, is that would be much simpler than one living organ, one living cell. And you have about 125 trillion of them in your body. And you have some cells that know how to become different types of cells. And other cells that only become the same kind of cell. And some cells do only this function, other cells do that function. And they all have instruction to know how to do it. Much more than what a Boeing 747 does. Darwin said this about complexity. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organism or organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, what does he say? My theory would absolutely break down. But I do not find such a case. Well, of course, you've got a 300 power magnifier there. Yes, your theory would absolutely break down if we could find a complexity that requires more than slight sequential modification. And we have. That is in our section on page 61. Irreducible complexity. I mean, in page 60, you'll see what I have listed there just for the human brain as an example. It's the most complex arrangement of matter in the universe. It's got 100 billion neurons, 12 billion cells, 120 trillion connections, 100 million nerves, 10,000 miles of fiber in about 3 pounds. That's not an accident, folks. And that doesn't come from disorder. That is a highly structured, highly intelligent, highly ordered, and very purposeful organ. Well, I'm sure you've heard of Michael Behe and Darwin's Black Box. Not written from a Christian perspective. He's a biochemist. He claims to be a Roman Catholic, but he wrote, again, not quoting the Bible and not talking about Christianity, but wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box as a disgruntled biochemist, saying that it just doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. And his main thesis, which has proven to be a very powerful thesis, is the thesis of irreducible complexity. His main argument is that if there is a living organ, even an organ, especially a full organism, if there is a living organ that is in any way irreducibly complex, meaning there are multiple parts that are interdependent for one function. If there are multiple parts interdependent for one function, it cannot be assembled, developed, evolved by evolution. And again, Darwin would agree with Behe. He said, my theory would absolutely break down if you can prove what Behe says is proven in biochemistry. The famous example he gives is the bacteria flagellum. It's a little tiny bacteria that has a tail that spins and causes it to propel all over the place. It's an amazing little guy. He has about 40 parts that are interdependent. And if you have one part break, it doesn't work. It's kind of like having an automobile. That if one part breaks, not all the parts, if any part breaks, it doesn't mean the car won't go. You can come and drive with me in my car. There's lots of broken parts. But there are certain parts that if just one of those certain parts breaks, you go nowhere. That's irreducibly complex. If one of those, if my battery cable is chopped, I go nowhere. I could have everything else in perfect condition. So that's the irreducibly complex components. And that's what Behe says we find in the bacterium flagellum. This little guy is amazing. He spins, this little tail spins about 100,000 RPMs. And what's amazing is in a quarter turn, a quarter revolution, 100,000 revolutions per minute, and in a quarter revolution, he can change direction. That's pretty sophisticated. We don't have anything like that. It has a stator, which is like a, it's basically like a conductor on a motor where it fires off in sequence and has different parts that fire off. And there's 32 of these little conductors that fire in sequence to make the thing spin. You know how fast they have to fire to make it spin 100,000 RPMs? They have to fire so fast in a circular fashion in perfect sequence. It's amazing. So they're firing off. If one of those goes bad, you have a problem. And the little guy dies because he can't propel himself. It has this propeller and a commutator. Well, of course, there's been a response to Behe's argument. And the response has been, oh, wait a second. You're making too much of this. Because we found bacteria that's like it. It looks a lot like it. In fact, it has a lot of the similar parts structurally. But what they don't tell you is, I actually watched the interview and I just laughed. I thought, are you kidding? You're really going to make an argument like that? You're missing the point. What they don't tell you is that the organisms that look like it don't function like it. And remember, the whole parameter was the parts needed to perform one function. Well, yeah, you can have a bacteria that's similar in structure, but functions differently. So this is an example. To mock Behe, a few evolutionary scientists came to a debate wearing ties that had a mousetrap without the latch and without the lever for the bait. Without those two pieces, so it only had the arm and the spring and the base. And they used it as a tie clip. They walk into the debate and they say, ha ha ha, your theory of irreducible complexity doesn't work. Because you said in your book, as an illustration, you can take a mouse trap and you have five parts: the base, the lever, the latch that holds it, the spring, and the little trigger. And if you take any one of those parts away, it's irreducibly complex. It doesn't work. And they said, ha ha, we got you. We took two parts away and it still works. And he kind of stopped and said, what? Are you serious? I didn't say that you couldn't use it as a piece of junk for something else. I said you couldn't use it as a mousetrap. You still can't use it as a mousetrap. Yeah, you can make it a paperweight. Who cares? That's not evolution. That's not what happens in evolution. The idea of irreducible complexity is there's an advantage feature that has been realized and it has built progressively, slowly. How do you get to the advantage feature like an eyeball with 137 million nerve endings that requires everything in place for the retina to receive light and have the cornea and have the fluid and have the dilation, have everything with light-sensitive cells and the connecting 40 million connecting nerves to the brain? How do you have all that slowly? Like, what, you're going to have 500,000 years of a guy with just all this apparatus and none of it's working while it's waiting to build the next part? And the next, it's not going to build the next part if it doesn't offer an advantage. According to natural selection, you have the mousetrap that right now is just a tie clip. Well, the mousetrap that's a tie clip will never become a mousetrap, because the mousetrap that's a tie clip will find no advantage to become a better tie clip by adding a latch. The only way it'll add a latch is if it could become a mousetrap. But it would never survive trying to become a mousetrap without a latch. You have problems on all areas. The point is, just to encourage you, the argument still stands. Irreducible complexity is unanswered. Another example, and I think this one really is one that they don't like to talk about, and that is blood clotting. If you talk to microbiologists, they tell us that blood clotting is a very complex system of 12 interdependent steps. If one of those steps fail, you don't clot. If you don't clot, you bleed to death. How do you have that in an evolutionary worldview? How do you have creatures that have blood circulating around that cannot clot. The very first time that blood is released from their body, they would die. Their offspring would not have an opportunity to evolve step one of a 12-step interdependent complexity. The reality is any creature with blood has to appear and does appear in the fossil record, by the way, all at once with every step of clotting in place. Irreducibly complex. This is Michael Behe. He says, to Darwin, the cell was a black box. Its inner workings were utterly mysterious to him. Now the black box has been opened up and we know how it works. Applying Darwin's test to the ultra-complex world of molecular machinery, the cellular systems that we have been discovered over the past 40 years, we can say that Darwin's theory is absolutely broken down. He quotes Darwin himself. Well, DNA is another example of this, and it's at the bottom there of 61. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. It's a fascinating little molecule of literally strands that can go billions long, and four sugars that constitute the alphabet. It has something, I don't know if I go over all this. Let's just think about some of this. I won't bore you with all the details. It's fascinating stuff, though. Chemistry is the vehicle, but not the source. Chemistry can't answer where DNA came from. It simply explains how it works. It's only a four-character language, and it's more complex than the English language, which has 26 characters. Why is that? Well, because in English, our way of reading is serial. We can only read a string of letters one way at one time. So we put a string of letters up and some spaces, and we can make sense out of it. Well, DNA works very different. In fact, it operates on something called pleiotropy. Pleiotropy means that there's a multidimensional feature of the language sequence. Four little sugar nucleotides connect and they form a sequence. What's fascinating is this little mitochondria can come in and unzip the nucleotides, and it can read DNA forward, backward, and intermittently as it chooses. In one strike, mitochondrial DNA can go through the protein, zip it open, and go through one little layer at lightning speed, and from that one little zip, it can identify up to four dimensions of information. That's something far more dense than anything we have in computer technology today. It can literally, like if you're a computer scientist out there, understand binary code, it would be like having the bits on the data sector, ones and zeros, and being able to read a sector sequentially with one swipe and be able on that one serial read have about four different levels of language. That's so dense, so compact, we still don't understand it. I've read the most recent works on it, they still don't understand it. It's just a fascinating thing. And so much interdependency. Consider this again. It's 1 times 10 to the 87th ways to construct one rung. Okay, it's a double helix. You've seen the picture, right, of DNA. It has these little rungs like ladder steps. And there's that many ways to construct one of those based on the sugar acids that are connected. And then it's unzipped, read, and put back together with this multidimensional data density. Think about this. In 4.5 billion years, what we would have if we took the probability of human life, as they claim is 4.5 billion years, or life on Earth, 4.5 billion years, then we would mathematically, based on that sequence, only have about 1 times 10 to the 25th seconds in that amount of time. There wouldn't be enough seconds in the length of nearly 5 billion years. There wouldn't be enough seconds that if every second trial for a different nucleotide was taken to come up with one rung on a strand of billions. DNA is so complex that one of the discoverers, Sir Francis Crick, when he was asked point blank, I said this earlier, so where do you think it came from? He says, look, there's nothing on earth that can account for it. It's far too complex to be attributed to evolution. So where do you think it came from? And his answer was, he believes aliens. And if you ask Richard Dawkins, he too believes that DNA must have come from aliens. They have more faith than I do. It's not merely chemicals, it's information, and that is going to bring us to our last point. I'm supposed to be ending now. I'm going to end us earlier, right? Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to close on that. We're not going to get to this next section. Let me ask you to jump with me, and I'll leave this for you to read later. So you can read artificial. I know there's a lot of information here, but you're going to be saturated already. So I'm not going to rush you through it. I just encourage you to read through what I've documented here for these other observations, artificial selection, altruism, sexual reproduction, symbiosis, attrition, genetics. I thought I was going to get through that. Whew. Biogenesis. Let me just make a comment about biogenesis and we'll end our session on page 70. Biogenesis is a very significant problem. Technically, it is not a problem of evolution, except that it is a requirement for naturalism. Biogenesis means where did life come from? Evolution is predicated on reproduction. Living organisms capable of reproducing. That's how natural selection works. Natural selection does not work on rocks. It works on the reproductive cycle. What does that assume? That assumes you have life. What else does it assume? It assumes that life can reproduce. What else does it assume? It assumes that reproduction happens and that in that process, mutation can take place. So there are lots of assumptions that evolution just takes. Biogenesis is one of those assumptions that is necessary. It has to explain where life came from originally. Where did it start? Well, I still had all that. Look at there. Ooh. So can you jump me all the way, please, to the end on biogenesis? If we could just look with me on page, I'll just take us to the end on 70. You could read the quotes on biogenesis. It's very helpful, edifying to understand. The point about it is there has been no scientific explanation for the origin of life. Life is still, by scientists, considered a mystery. They don't quite understand. And let me just give you one example that's helpful to me, because I'm a physicist, not a biologist. What's helpful to me is to understand the matter that's involved in life. So let's just now imagine that we have a, you know, poor little frog. So here he is up on the apparatus before you. And we had the instrumentation to measure his life and its end. And let's say we can measure it down to the nanosecond. So I'm going to draw a line, and that line represents the death of the frog. And I'm going to have that frog being weighed, and I'm going to have other apparatus measuring the activity in the frog's cellular composition. And I'm going to measure the time, and we watch the frog die. In 1 nanosecond before the frog dies, he weighs XYZ. In 1 nanosecond after the frog dies, he still weighs XYZ. In 1 nanosecond before the frog dies, all of the cells are arranged in a certain order, in a certain place. 1 nanosecond after it dies, in the exact same order, in the exact same place. 1 nanosecond before, there's a certain level of hydration, there's a certain chemistry and balance. 1 nanosecond after, it's all the same chemically. So from a physicist's perspective, it helps me to think about this. The difference between the nanosecond before when the frog was alive and the nanosecond after when the frog is dead, there is no measurable physical difference. None. 1 nanosecond before, all of its cells are operating and interacting and communicating. And 1 nanosecond after, they stop. And no one can tell you why. Life is still a mystery. And it's that very mystery that presents the problem that it cannot start just by arranging matter. You can't just get the right material and put it in the right place and you'll have life. It is not mechanics. It's a wonderful gift of a living God. So end with this on page 70, these three points that I want to give you. If we can go, can we go to the very end, please? I think it's the last slide. I can do it from memory, but it's helpful to see it up on the screen. Basically, the three things I really want you to walk away from this session, the three big things, I know I've said a lot, and there's a lot more there. The three big things are simply this. Number one, the origin of life. You need to have biogenesis. Number one, origin of life. So this would be the biogenesis that we just talked about. In order for natural selection to work, because natural selection in its limited scope of identifying how reproducible organisms vary, in as much as it says that, it's science, that it requires, however, it requires the origin of life to be answered. For it to be rational, for biology to work, you must first assume the origin of life. Number two. Not only the origin of life, but you must have information. You have to get this, and please write this down and make a star or something. This is a massive argument. If you get nothing else from this session about what do we think about when we think about evolution, what are our arguments to be able to interact intelligently and kindly with people? Take these three things, write them down, memorize them, put them in your pocket. Make sure you can talk on these three points. You need to be able to answer where life comes from. And it's too complex to be just the matter of matter arranged. Number two, you need to be able to answer information. You see, the whole theory of evolution as it progresses, mutations occur and so forth. And I'll try to touch on that in the next session. But the idea here is each time something happens, there's a loss of information. And if it's not a loss, it's a rearrangement of information. But mutations never create new volumes of information. First and foremost, the information that a mutation has to work with is a fixed alphabet. There is what's called by geneticists a genetic capacity. That's why you can breed chickens all day long and you'll never get a chicken the size of an elephant. No matter if you take the biggest chickens every time. You'll never get one as big as an elephant because the genetic capacity of that creature is limited. The point then is that there is a fixed, limited vocabulary in the genetics itself, and that fixed, limited vocabulary is an information set that can be distorted, to be sure, and can be rearranged so that you can get fly wings where the legs are supposed to go. Big deal. You still put the fly wings somewhere, and you didn't explain where the fly wings came from. By the way, that's a footnote on the answer to why fruit flies do not prove evolution. Okay, there we go. And our last one is irreducible complexity. You've got to have these three things. Origin of life, information, where did the information come from? How did you get this highly complex pleiotropic DNA strand that has more information in it? It's said that there's more information in an amount of DNA in a single teaspoon. This is an amazing statement. There is claimed to be more information in a single teaspoon of DNA than all the books that have ever been written in the history of humanity and every word that has ever been spoken in a teaspoon. That's a lot of information, folks. So you have to answer where the information came from, how it is it can tell when to start making the hair go gray, when to stop that follicle, when and how far to make that nose, what color to make that hue in the eye, how long to make that eyelash. Every detail of your body and when your body does something. Make sure he doesn't start, you know, growing facial hair until he's about 13 or 14. I don't want a little five-year-old having beards. So, you know, what does that? It's not mom and dad, it's the DNA does that. Fascinating God and the details that he has made. These are the three arguments. Please take these to heart. Origin of life, you've got to answer it. Got to answer information, and you've got to answer the irreducible complexity. With that in mind, I do want to pray, and we're going to have a break. And we'll gather again back about 3:30. But let's take a break for now, and then we're going to come back. Oh, I'm sorry. That was reading ahead. We're going to come back around, let's say, yes, 2:20. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for this opportunity. I do pray your grace upon each one. Refresh them now as they get up and they take a break. I ask again your grace to be upon us as we think through these things. Help us to steward them well for your honor, your glory, and our joy. In Christ, amen.